Welcome to Pod Space Nine, the last stop for trash in the Alpha Quadrant. This is a rewatch podcast for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, featuring two veteran viewers and one newbie. My name is Justin, and I'll be your way team commander. Joining me is my science officer, Anna, our new recruit, Jude, and our visiting chief petty officer, Steve. Jude, Anna, Steve, how are you doing?
Well, frankly, I'm a little offended because you demoted me in the intro. I am not a new recruit.
Oh my gosh.
I am acting ensign. I worked hard for that ugly sweater. Thank you very much.
Keeps, why have we not edited the template? I'm going nuts. Somebody's edited it back. I swear to God.
I'm good. Excited to have a guest with us tonight. And a new guest at that. Very excited.
Yeah.
Speaking of, yes, welcome to the show, Steve. Could you please introduce yourself a little bit?
Yes. Chief Petty Officer Steve, reporting for duty today. Very glad to be here. I am, my pronouns are they and them. So please use those, listeners, if you're going to yell at me about this episode later. I'm from the internet. That's where I live. I'm on the site formerly known as Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on all those social medias at Howdy Duda. It's HOWDYDUDA. Yeah, I don't know. If you've ever heard of me before, it is probably from appearing on a podcast of various kinds. But I'm happy to be here talking about maybe my first love, Star Trek.
Awesome.
Yes, I think I first encountered you because of another love, which was X-Men.
I was going to say, was it X-Men or was it wrestling?
I was going to say when you said another love, and it's going to be either X-Men or wrestling, and like, even money.
I hate how like narrowly targeted I am, but that is like, frankly, I curate my Twitter feed incredibly well.
Yeah, the X-Men and Star Trek people are numerous. The X-Men, Star Trek, and wrestling people, those are like a very nice. It's a choice vintage.
Yeah, it's a very neat Venn diagram. So Steve, how did you get into Star Trek?
When I was a small child, my dad was watching The Next Generation as it was airing. And then eventually, you know, Deep Space Nine and Voyager as well. It was always on in the house. I think I would say First Contact is one of the earliest like TV movies that I watched over and over that I have very good memories of, beyond like the things I watched as like a 3-year-old or whatever, like Wizard of Oz. And The Wrath of Khan is a movie that I've seen maybe hundreds of times, but still don't remember everything. That's nice. Always manages to surprise me every time.
I guess because this is a DS9 one, what is your relationship to DS9 specifically?
Oh, well, okay. So DS9, I didn't get to watch a lot of when I was a kid. I ended up gravitating a lot towards Voyager's weirdness. And then after a short time, I was like moving on to other things with my television watching experience, just like getting into other sci-fi and doing other things. When streaming became available, sorry to any children listening to this podcast, when streaming became a thing, I started going back and like, you know, rewatching all this stuff for the first time, like in its entirety since my youth, and, you know, seeing stuff that wasn't always in reruns. And Deep Space Nine was a big hole in my memory. And the friends I was developing at that time were people who were really into military sci-fi. And I was getting into more and more nuanced depictions of governmental organizations in my science fiction, so to speak. And Deep Space Nine filled a very nice hole in that. I should say I'm also like a gigantic fan of the Battlestar Galactica Reimagined series. I watched it as it was coming out. I've had the DVDs for years, and I recently got the Blu-ray box set. Highly recommend getting that if you can. It's a great way to watch.
Do you have the Blu-ray box set? Is it like the big square box with the Cylon toy?
Yeah, mine did not have a Cylon toy. No, but it is a big square box. That's for sure.
Somewhere in the closet back there, there's like a collector's edition that's like a big chunky box.
The one I've got. Yep.
Of course, as you gestured there, Justin, I think you're going to have to share with our listeners when we release this what your background is, because as you gestured back, all I saw was you gesturing at a picture of Dukat. I'm like, Dukat in the closet? That's a headcanon I've never seen before.
Yes, it appears to be a PowerPoint presentation collage of a bunch of meme pictures of Dukat's face.
It's specifically seriously
fuck this guy written behind him.
It's a parody of the do it for him do it for her Simpsons.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing.
The reason you were on, Steve, is because this is one of the, I think this is one of the most seminal this is one of the bigger two-parters, and I wanted to have a guest on it because we didn't have a guest for our big three-parter to start off the season. And having another person here to join the madness is always fun.
Especially for a banger two-parter like this one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Tonight we are covering the two-parter of The Maquis. The following summary is going to, what we're going to do is we're going to do it like we did the Homecoming Circle Siege, where we're going to do our summaries first, and then we'll get into discussion, just because it's not like, this is something that we will get into, but like, for whatever reason, DS9 decided they weren't going to ever do the TNG / Voyager style of two-parter, where they cliffhanger a season on part one and start part two at the start of a new season, for which I am incredibly thankful for, because it's a really dumb.
Yeah. And you're always playing with fire with that too, because like it worked out pretty well for TNG on the whole, but then you have like Farscape that did that and then was canceled.
I hate being reminded of that. I'm sorry. That was involuntary.
I can hear the previously on Star Trek, The Next Generation, Majel Barrett's narration in the first episode of a season as they like catch you up on the first part of the two-parter. Because I watched those two-parters. I got so wrapped up in like the to be continued that narration is like burned into my brain as like what narrative tension sounds like.
Speaking of, I do feel like this episode, or these episodes, would have benefited from at the beginning of the Maquis part one. I feel like it should have had a previously on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Just to like get us in there, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Next Generation two-parters, the Best of Both Worlds part one is a funny story of my pre-life. Because my dad remembers watching Best of Both Worlds with my godfather in like the little apartment that he had with my mom. They'd been married for like, they would have been married for like 3 months. And my mom's pregnant with me, and like they get to the end of the episode. It's I am Locutus of Borg, da, 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 da. And then Riker says fire. And then it cuts to be continued. And apparently, my dad and my godfather, Uncle Kevin, threw such a fit that my mom started getting sick.
Oh no.
They were just like, they were having a meltdown, and they were just like, oh my gosh.
Well, like, it's good to know that you come by your Star Trek bullshit honestly, Justin.
I'm trying to imagine any television show doing that now.
Right?
In the age where you have social media, nobody could wait till the next season to find out, like, so did he really die? He's like a zombie now? What the fuck?
Westworld was, I think, the last time anybody tried to do shit like that.
I mean, I'm lying. Obviously, there's great television that'll do stuff like that. Just, yeah, premium.
Yeah.
HBO.
But yeah, well, I mean, these days, they do it very differently. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. You have the first one, right, Justin?
Yes. All right. So we're doing episodes 20 and 21. I've got episode 20, The Maquis, part one. Story by Rick Berman, Michael Piller, Jerry Taylor, and James Crocker. Teleplay by James Crocker, directed by David Livingston.
Takes a village.
Yeah, especially with a two-parter like this one, like a relatively plot-heavy one. So we start off our two-parter with some Cardassians on the station who are loading some things onto their ship. As they depart, we see a dude in a Starfleet uniform do something to the ship as it's docked. In Ops, Kira and Dax talk about boy troubles, and Dax picks up something on the Bok-Nor's readings. The freighter explodes, vaporizing the ship and killing all aboard. O'Brien and Kira go out on a runabout to try to search the wreckage, but they can't find any evidence of a bomb. The Cardassians are quiet, leading people to believe they're planning something in retaliation. The crew does find a metal that's only used in Starfleet shield generators, and they believe that it was an implosive device of some sort. Commander Cal Hudson, a friend of Sisko and Curzon's from their past and an attaché in the Federation Demilitarized Zone's colonies, arrive on station to work with Ben on the situation. The situation in the DMZ is awkward. The colonists refused to evacuate when the new treaty was signed and feels that the Federation gave away too much, leaving them in the hands of the Cardassians, despite the Federation's offers to relocate them. The Bokhtar's destruction makes things a lot more desperate. Calvin warns that the Cardassians might make a play across the Bajoran border instead of the Federation's. We then see the Starfleet officer who'd done something to the freighter talking to a Vulcan who gives him quarters in the station. Observing them are two aliens. The Vulcan, Sikona, then goes into Quark's and wants to conduct business with him, so they set up a dinner meeting. The dude from earlier is then kidnapped by the two aliens in a hallway. Sisko arrives back in his quarters, but he in fact gets the worst downgrade from Jake as a greeting. Fucking Dukat. Dukat says he slipped on board the station for a freighter, unofficially, to help them find out the truth about the Bokhtar. He says that the Federation is responsible, and he wants to prove it. They're going to go to a colony in the DMZ to investigate. They verbally banter on the runabout on the way to the colony, including talking about Dukat's perception of Sisko as a joyless curmudgeon. They find a Federation merchant vessel with Cardassian craft attacking it. They can't raise the vessel, and Dukat tries to get the Cardassian ships to disengage with his authority. As they approach, a Federation ship that seems to be a modified courier engages the Cardassian ships and destroys them. Quark and Sikona meet over dinner as Quark just lays all of his game down and tries to woo her. Sikona wishes to buy arms, a large amount of weapons. Quark is surprised and frankly like a little shocked that a Vulcan is buying guns. On the colony, Ben and Dukat arrive to find Hudson and a Cardassian, Gull Ivek, arguing over the attack. The Cardassian insists that they have every right to defend themselves from terrorists, and when Sisko says the Federation doesn't support terrorism, Ivek provides the confession of the man who destroyed the Bokhtar. Sisko plays it, which is a full and complete confession for the man. The Cardassian then produce him, well, his body at least, and claims he committed suicide in his cell. Hudson says that the situation is spiraling out of control, and the Cardassians are arming the colonists under the table. Sisko makes the point the Cardassians have third parties often involved with weapons smuggling. Hudson expresses some sympathies with the colonists, that he feels like the Federation abandoned them. On the ride back to the station, Dukat reveals he knew about the confession, but he did not know that the terrorist was dead. Sisko confronts Dukat about the possibility of the Bokhtar carrying weapons, but he says that he would have known. Sikona arrives to finish the deal, and Quark is frankly so down bad that I can't stop laughing. Dukat is assigned guest quarters while the investigation continues, and Sisko gets his report from O'Brien. It was a Federation implosion device. Sisko advises Kira the Bajorans shouldn't have any worries about the Cardassians, and Kira tries to warn him that the Cardassians can't be trusted. Sikona and a man posing as a security officer abduct Dukat. Sisko tries to find the ship that took him, and a transmission from the group responsible identifies themselves as the Maquis. Oh, hey, we get a title drop. Yay! They ID the ship from the warp signature, which is hiding in the Badlands, and a patch of space that's very temperamental. They find human life signs and prepare to beam down on a planet in the Badlands. They are greeted by Cal Hudson and an armed squad who are there to confront Sisko. And after that frankly, like, exhausting part one, I'm crawling to the corner and tagging in Jude.
Whoa, shit! Cal is the Maquis? Who could have seen that coming? Oh, wait, everyone did. Cal gives Sisko a little chat, and when Sisko does not agree to let him turn DS9 into their personal repair depot and weapon shipping platform, because that was entirely realistic, Sisko, Kira, and Julian, who I guess is there on the theory that he's irresistible to Cardassians? Unclear. All get tased. Dun, dun, dun. They get back to DS9, apparently no worse the wear, to learn there's a Starfleet admiral on the station and a Cardassian legate en route. So Ben's day is going great, and it only gets better when it turns out that the admiral is the one on TNG that they always trot out when they want you to hate someone, whose name I didn't catch, so I'm going to call her Admiral Karen, as that sort of feels appropriate. Anyway,
it is in fact. I hate to be this person, but it is Nechayev. Admiral Alina Nechayev.
Yes, it's Nechayev, our old good friend Nechayev.
Who, like, I knew she was coming in this episode, but still, immediately, my response upon seeing her is, "Oh, go fuck off and die."
I would like to also point out that she is specifically also in Journey's End, which is the episode in TNG that establishes the stuff that's going on with the border treaty that is leading into all of this.
That's cool. I'm going to stick with Karen because she has the Karen haircut. She has the permanent, I smell something bad look on her face. And it just sort of feels right. She opens the conversation by referring to Odo as shapeshifter, the way all Karens pronounce the names of peoples they don't like. And then tells him the colonists are dumb. The Maquis are just troublemakers, and they need to get in line. But she's sure they'll, quote, listen to reason. Sisko, perhaps understandably, is not yet ready to throw his old friend under this particularly bigoted bus just yet. Sisko then goes on a rant about how Earth is apparently the well-manicured gated community of the Federation, but realizes he's ranting at Kira now. Kira, I've been murdering Cardassians since I was a kid, Nerisse, and not the person who really needs the rant, and checks his shit. Before Sisko meets with the Legate, however, he has to deal with Quark, who, in his very public courting of Sakona, has been identified as one of her co-conspirators. After a few catty ear jokes from his jealous boyfriend Odo, he gives up the info that he helped her buy a lot of weapons. Sisko finally meets with the Legate, who promptly throws Dukat under the bus like a sack of potatoes, pinning the weapon sales in the DMZ on him and ordering Sisko to give up looking for Dukat on the theory that he'll either be killed by the Cardassians or killed by the Maquis, so why bother? The Cardassian makes it very clear that preserving the treaty is of central importance. O'Brien, meanwhile, is narrowed down, sort of, where Dukat might be, and Sisko readies his posse to go find his new frenemy, much to Kira's confusion. Once again bringing Julian, who I legitimately forgot as a doctor might have a reason to be there. It was only in writing the summary that I realized there was a reason to bring Julian on this other than the fact that he is irresistible to Cardassians. She thinks they should let him die, but Sisko figures the Cardassian ruling council wants him dead. That's enough reason to save him. In generic cave set, Quark's Vulcan crush Sakona is trying to mind meld on Dukat, but it's not working. Dukat responds by trying to provoke them into torturing him. I don't know if this is a thing that Dukat's got going on or if this he's trying to get them to kill him before he breaks. It's unclear. It really comes off, though, like he's just kind of like in it for the giggles, though. It's a weird scene.
Dukat is a weird man, to be fair.
He is a weird little guy.
He follows this up by provoking things into a brief but futile firefight, which sort of reinforces that belief. And Sisko ends up letting one of them go to run back to Cal. Back on DS9, Dukat seems tickled by what has transpired, chowing down on a hearty meal with the smug satisfaction of a cat that has caught the canary, baked it, and is having it with a nice glass of wine. Sisko pisses in his cornflakes, however, by letting them know how Central Command has thrown him under the bus. It's so rare to see Dukat with the wind taken out of his sails, it's real refreshing. Dukat then reveals that Central Command is indeed smuggling in arms, but didn't tell him about it. He makes a deal with Sisko, stop the smuggling in exchange for stopping the Maquis. They take a runabout and go hunting smugglers and track down a shipment being carried by the Zeppelites. There are so many weird fucking alien species name dropped in this episode. There's six. Gallimites?
The Gallimites, the Eridians, the Lesepians.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. I am honestly flabbergasted that you named all of those in one shot.
This is my curse.
For context, I never watched this show as a kid. I missed this one, so I'm like the newbie watcher that was mentioned in the header. But like, so I'm coming into this one pretty blank. That's why I'm confused.
They dropped the Zeppelites in here for the first time just so that you could be like, "Well, I've never heard of them," and he's like, "Well, of course you haven't. They've never been caught.
Zeppelites were cool, but were cool before." Let's see. Oh yeah. After some unsuccessful federationing, Sisko is unable to talk the Zeppelites from simply surrendering and refuses to just phaser them the way that Dukat suggests they do. Sisko does manage to get them to surrender by letting Dukat get on the radio and threaten to phaser them. Sisko is apparently not comfortable using Dukat's tactics, but he is comfortable using Dukat's threat of his tactics to get what he wants, which is a weird ethical leg to stand on, but we can talk about that later. At Dukat's threat, the Zeppelites lower shields and agree to all of his demands. Back on DS9, Quark does, hands down, my favorite scene of these two episodes. Quark does an absolutely insane flirt, arguing for peace via the logic of the rules of acquisition with Sakona. It is
incredible.
The lobiest goddamn thing I've ever seen from Quark. It's magnificent. And it works. He out-logics a Vulcan and gets her to give up the information about the depot, which they then use, they take to Dukat, and they use to get the location of the, they combine with Dukat's information to track down Cal and his and the Maquis. Sisko, meanwhile, has gone to deliver his ultimatum to reject the Maquis to the colonists, and Cal shows up. Cal rejects his offer emphatically by vaporizing his uniform before stomping out. He wants a war with the Cardassians, and he's intent to get it. The DS9 crew pile into three runabouts with Dukat and get ready to prevent the Maquis attack, intent on preventing Cal and his gang from getting their war. The skirmish is short and, frankly, fairly underwhelming. Unsurprisingly, it quickly comes down to Sisko versus Cal, with Dukat egging Sisko on. In the end, they drive the Maquis away, and Dukat is bummed to discover that his new bro Sisko is not as bloodthirsty as he had imagined. In the epilogue, Sisko muses morosely to Kira about the accolades Starfleet is sending him and about the inevitability of war. I want to give context for this episode for me. I never watched much DS9. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, the pilot episode of Voyager is burned into my memory. So I knew exactly what the Maquis were going into this episode. Yeah. And in my memory, they're much more impressive than the bunch of doofuses in this episode.
I love that they also like drop in with the Badlands, like, oh, and there have even been ships lost there recently.
It really they really do.
It's nice setup.
Yeah, they were told to establish the Maquis in this, like in TNG season 7, because Voyager was on the boilerplate and they wanted to establish this before they got the show up and running.
The Maquis are so cool in Voyager, and it's such a shame. I know it's been said a million times. It's such a shame that they just didn't keep the tension boiling. They were like, oh, this is too tense. This is too tense for Star Trek. Too much conflict.
So I find the Maquis to be an incredibly... this is going to be like an overarching thing that we will talk about throughout the next couple seasons. It's what Dukat describes in, like, when he's being held captive there, that they theoretically have this goal that they want to be achieving by committing terrorism. But the Maquis are, like, just sort of, like... It's like if a bunch of, like, lawful, stupid paladins all decided they wanted to do terrorism.
I can improve on this metaphor very slightly.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of college, like, freshman philosophy majors who go out and decide that they're going to put their philosophy 201 ethics into action and try and do a little bit of utilitarianism out in space, and suddenly discover that it doesn't actually work that way.
Well, that's who was writing Star Trek. if you want to take a look at this episode from a very similar perspective to that, I think that the best way that I think about the Maquis nowadays, because I've been a huge fan of the Maquis forever, but I'm a huge fan of the potential and not the realization, is there, if listeners, if you have seen Falcon and the Winter Soldier, flashback to the Flag Smashers and that crushing disappointment you might have felt in those final episodes, that's the Maquis through and through. Mm-hmm. Is they're this problem of the most interesting thing to me politically that Star Trek has really ever done with the Federation, besides like Section 31, is like ask the question, like, what happens when you try to achieve diplomacy with a culture that doesn't want to cooperate, that isn't really interested in what you're interested in. You have this friction at the edges of that, right? And then they're like, well, they're just in it for a personal war and they're kind of dumb, right? So that helps resolve the problem.
I think part of the problem is that the Maquis don't actually have an end goal. Which is, I mean, that could be considered to be a major problem with a lot of movements, like in the real world. But I think that one of the things is that, like, the reference that the Maquis is that there are two groups that refer to themselves as the Maquis in the mid 20th century. There are the French Maquis, which are mainly working class people who fled the cities of France while it was occupied to escape compulsory workforces, who later then turned into a resistance movement. And one of the interesting things about the Maquis is that the Maquis did not have a uniting political ideology.
Mm.
There was everything from like anarchists and socialists to right-wing nationalists, French nationalists who were in the Maquis, who were basically the only things that they had uniting them were fuck the Nazis and fuck Vichy France.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, the effectiveness of them as an organization is wildly variable. There's also the Spanish Maquis, which are, I think, a little they're a little less talked about, but they are interesting because they're a resistance to Franco's regime that actually were exiled and then got rearmed by the Allies and sent back into Spain in the late 40s. But I think the problem with the Maquis is that, I mean, first of all, I think that it's a failing on the actual premise of it is very confusing that we don't actually know, is the demilitarized zone a neutral zone? Is it Cardassian territory that just isn't allowed to have weapons in it? Because they mentioned that there are Cardassian colonies on the border that are now in Federation space.
Yeah.
But like, how does this work actually?
It appears to be an overlap between the two zones, right? There's Cardassian space with Federation colonies in it and vice versa. Yeah. And there's an area in between where there's not supposed to be any war, but there is.
Yeah, they don't set the scene very well. Ben has a speech when he's in like full-on rant mode to Kira. He has that great analogy where he talks about Earth, where he's like ranting about how these yuckles from Earth don't understand because they look out the windows on Earth and see paradise, and then they get onto the galaxy and it's like, oh, it's not paradise, and they don't get it. They don't understand the way the galaxy works because they've been living in this weird utopia. And I think they were so close to actually like having a good point there and like having a kernel of something that the Maquis were trying to say in that moment. But then the actual Maquis don't remotely succeed in verbalizing what they're trying to say nearly as eloquently as Avery Brooks does.
Although remember Sisko's speech, though. Like, keep that in your head as we go forward.
Yeah.
He's very much doing the, they can afford to be nice from Parasite a little bit, except for without the hardcore commitment to that aesthetic and ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it is one of my favorite, like, it's one of my favorite lines, because I think that there is, Anna and I will be doing, that recording will come out a lot sooner than this one, but we're going to be doing a talk with a fan fiction author about the competing ideologies of what the Federation is trying to achieve versus realistic execution. And I think that, like, I find it really interesting to see like people, because we don't get a lot of background history on what the actual Cardassian War was beyond that it was like brutal. The interesting thing that I've heard, like that I've talked about with somebody that we've like, you know, talked about, is that it's a, like, I think that it is a probably bad move by the Federation, done because the Federation, like Nechayev says, wants basically peace at any cost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's always gone well. That's never been a problem in human history.
Quark makes such a good good point, like a shockingly good point, when he argues that you want peace at any cost, but peace is at an all-time low right now. Like, escalation is expensive, diplomacy is cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so good. That's really smart, actually.
That scene is so good.
It's Quark, truly not capitalist, but very utilitarian.
Quark is unbelievable in that scene. I love Quark kind of all the time. He's this scummy little rat that is so good. But my God, his swag in this episode is out of control. He is swinging for the fences with Sakira, and he's got no chance, you would think. But he is, he's that close by the end.
I think she's into it. I think she's into it.
Oh, yeah, by the end?
She says he intrigues her.
We don't see how that, what happens in that cell at the end of that episode. I mean.
Can we talk about Sakona? Just like, she's so hot.
My
notes for this episode are just like, she has a great jaw. She wants to buy weapons. Quark is scared and turned on.
We've all been there.
I mean,
yeah. That dress she's in, it's amazing.
We've talked extensively on this podcast about the fact that Quark wants to be stepped on by strong women.
Primarily strong alien women.
Specifically. And like, this is like, I've gotten my notes. Quark wants a hot alien lady to step on him. Example 23561.
Right? Yeah. But God, he's certainly
great.
But you're right. That his speech there, I mean, it's not only an incredible act of
he outlogics a Vulcan.
He's got the lobes for it.
It's incredibly, incredibly smooth. Yeah, it's just an incredible scene. I love it. I love that whole scene. He is so smooth and right somehow. Mm-hmm. It was just terrific. God help. I hope she stepped on him. He deserves it. He worked hard and he earned it.
Quark is maybe one of the only people in the entire history of media that I can point to as like a capitalist for the good. Not always. He's obviously a very bad person most of the time, but often he is lobbying these ideas in such a way as to achieve some kind of good. And, in this case, the good is actually selling weapons at a considerable discount, as he assures the sheriff.
I think it's one of those things that it's like, I think that like, despite all of his protestations and his like, there are two competing things within Quark, that he wants to be the ideal Ferengi, but he is also at his core, he is actually a good person.
Yeah.
It's just that these two is that you cannot be like a capitalist and a good person.
It's the two wolves inside him.
Yeah. But I think that overall it's like it's a fun thing because it's like overall it's like, oh hey, there's just this plot. It's a B plot really, and then it just comes up into the A plot, which I love.
Yeah. It's so good. God, what I want to shake the hand of whoever wrote that, because they just nailed it. Just absolutely classic. So
the writing is so phenomenal, especially not only that, but like there's a lot of good reversals in this, like the Nechayev being like the Maquis are irresponsible, and Sisko coming back with they're responsible for blowing up the Bak-Nor. Like the bit about like you're the most joyless and least vulnerable person I've ever met. That's so good.
True. Yeah.
So let's talk about
joyful, but never around Dukat.
Yeah. Burgeoning bromance of Dukat and Sisko.
I love that he just like lets himself into Sisko's quarters and thinks that this is going to make a good impression. And I think that this is like something that Mark Alaimo has said about playing Dukat, is that he went into every scene being like, no, Dukat is always in the right.
Yeah.
And it shows that Dukat's there in Sisko's quarters, fully convinced that this is a fantastic idea, and Sisko will love it, and Sisko will be like amused and surprised that Dukat is sitting there in his quarters instead of like horrified and willing to shoot him on sight.
And he looks so genuinely offended that Sisko would suggest that he did something to Jake. Like, it never even occurs to him that Sisko would go there. He's like, you wound me, sir.
I think it is because...
Go ahead.
I think it's a thing of, like, Cardassians. Cardassians, as a culture, do have a flair for dramatics.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
They basically have two moves. They have their flair for the dramatic, and their flair for the dramatic they bring out amongst people that they are operating from, like, that they're operating on a assumption that they are somewhat equal with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We see that.
Like when he's dealing with Sisko with this, when he's dealing with people he sees as beneath him, though. Like, when Cardassians deal with people they see as beneath them, they become an entirely different people.
Like, look at how Dukat acts with Sisko versus with Kira.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes, from monster to Ace Frehley dressed, sitting in a chair like Darkseid, playing the victim. Yeah.
They're so good in this episode. Every scene the two of them are together, Dukat is trying so hard to get Sisko to think that they're buds. And he's oblivious to how badly it's going. Not as badly as it could, because I think Sisko is genuinely like, I think Sisko's thought process is somewhere along the lines of, he hasn't tried to kill me, and he hasn't betrayed us yet.
Yeah.
And genuinely, I think he's a little surprised that he gets all the way through this adventure. And Dukat is more or less on the up and up with him front to back.
And that's, more or and less. That's a fascinating thing about Dukat is that he both is like, he's this weird mixture of like honest and dishonest. And like, you never know which one it's going to be.
It's whichever suits him is the thing, you know. He's so manipulative. The mind games in this particular episode are really intense, and he's always doing it, you know, like he completely denying until he's proven wrong or something happens that shocks him, and then it's switched tracks to something better. He constantly talks about how the justice system of Cardassia never makes mistakes. And then seconds after he says that, he finds out that the government sold him out and wants his death. And he's so shocked. He's so shocked. It undermines everything he's been trying to convince Sisko of, too. And it's like, or what's the plan now?
The names of the people who worked on the story and tell plays for those episodes are like a lot of a lot of the big names in the DS9 writers room. And this feels like the exact point where they decide that Dukat is the dark mirror to Sisko, or at least it's the origin point of it.
Yeah.
Because like there's all these little things in the episode where they are there like directly contrasting Sisko and Dukat. Like, we learned that Dukat is a family man.
Yeah, he's got
seven kids. I have seven.
Which I the and like they're
we'll
both,
return we'll return to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was watching that with my partner, he exclaimed something exactly at that number. So yeah.
But I think one of the interesting things is like they've both lived in the same quarters. They both had the same office. Oh.
He won't let him forget every single time he's in his room where he broke into without anybody knowing. He's like, yeah, I could break in here anytime. I used to live here. And then he's back in the office later. He's like, I love what you've done with my place.
Yeah.
I'm going to pour some wine.
It's and like between that, like they're both people who are at odds with their government and superiors. We get all of these like these parallels between them that they both, at least for this episode, have similar goals, that they want to stop a war from happening because it's in neither of their interests.
Yeah.
And I just think like, and frankly, Brooks and Alemo just fucking nail it.
Crush it.
They're incredible together.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just one of those things of, you let him cook, and they're gonna go back to this well so many times. which like
it's a great well though.
It's a really good well. That's some good water. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that overall this is really the first episode that we get this. There are points in this series that we will get to where Dukat will almost be heroic. He will at least at points be a protagonist. But I think it all comes from this episode.
Yeah.
And like the dynamic they started to see here.
Yeah. This show is so good. The thing I love about Deep Space Nine, as opposed to all the other Star Trek shows really, is that it's so good at like presenting you with these characters that you have to hold two things in your mind about at the same time to understand them. And that's really challenging. Like, you like this guy is Bajoran Hitler, you know?
Yes.
Like he is. In this episode, he literally says the High Command was upset with me for not killing them all, and I probably should have. He regrets not having done that openly, as if it's a casual conversation thing. Fuck you. But at the same time, he will save people's lives. He will make compassionate choices later on. He will reveal depths and nuance to himself over time and changing attitudes. And then, you know, Kaiopaka, God rest.
Yeah.
And then there'll be like, and then at the end of the episode, like after everything they've gone through together, Dukat's final remark to him is like that he Sisko refuses to fire on his friend because he cannot bring himself to kill a terrorist because it is his friend, even though this is somebody who is actively committing treason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He refuses to sell him out. Like without even missing a beat when Machayev is like, you got to figure this out. He's like, oh, I don't know who I don't. Yeah, I'll check on him. I'll see how he's doing.
Yeah, it's quite slick, actually.
He does not even for a second act like he's going to say like, oh, yeah, he's joined the Maquis.
Yeah. And Sisko, part of that is I think Sisko is he does for all he rails on the naivete of what you see in San Francisco and the Palais de la Concorde, like of Earth, like the command, like Starfleet and the Federation. Like he is a he is somebody who believes in the idea of the Federation of forgiveness, and that like there are not, like Sisko at this point believes that like this is, he is not far gone enough. He can be like, these are things that can be forgiven. He can come back. We can try to work this out. And I think that is like, I think it's an interesting like contrast to the speech he gives in the early parts of the second part. But when he refuses to do that, Dukat is fucking pissed. He calls him weak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like personally hurt.
Well, cause Dukat was going to kill his own people with, you know, immediately. He considered it the honorable thing to do. He's like, my people fired on your people. I should kill them. Arm photons.
Yeah, because I think like with Dukat, it is a lesser crime to kill an innocent person than to leave a job unfinished.
I think you're right there.
Or like a unnecessary death is nothing if the job's unfinished.
Do you think innocence even factors in for him, given the way that he admires the Cardassian justice system?
Correct. No, I do. I don't think so. I think we'll get into this either this season or next, but I mean, I think that the Cardassian idea of justice is so warped.
I don't think it's warped. I'm going to push back on that. I don't think it's warped. The Cardassians have demonstrated pretty clearly here that what is the greatest good in their ethical and justice code is what's the greatest good for their conception of Cardassia.
Yeah.
Yes. And the state is God for Cardassia.
Yeah. Order in the state.
Yeah. And for Dukat, that's the military government. Mm-hmm. And therefore, whatever innocence is only, as long as innocence isn't in conflict. And I think this is probably where we're going to see, I'm spitballing here, but where innocence conflicts with that, he doesn't care. But where innocence is not in conflict with the goals of the state, then he absolutely will act to preserve innocence, because that's the right thing to do.
I think you're right about that. I think we see that in this episode.
I also don't think that Dukat believes that anybody is innocent.
Yeah, I would.
I think that Dukat, like, genuinely believes that everybody is, like, deep down inside them as fucked up as he is.
Well, how could he not?
Right.
I mean, like, can a person like that look at the rest of the world and think that there's any justification for him to be the way he is?
Yeah.
I don't know. Does he think of himself as guilty? He doesn't seem... In this episode specifically, he doesn't really seem to feel guilt for his actions on Bajor, so much as regret for not having gone far enough, maybe. But
yeah, he looks pretty
unclear
casual about it.
Is he posturing?
One thing I'm curious about with this episode is that you've made me think about, Justin, talking about Sisko's background, is I'm very interested to see what Sisko's arc through this show is with regards to his relationship with the Federation. Because they introduce him as, like...
Hold on, I'm going to stare into the camera for 20 seconds, unblinking.
They introduce him at the start of as, like, the guy that tells Picard to go fuck himself, which was kind of new, right? The great honored Picard, and he tells him to go fuck off. And then we get... I mean, I think it was season one we get that episode where he refuses to abandon the station and, like... pretends to, like, have all sorts of technical trouble so that they can stay on the station. Sisko is a guy that already has demonstrated that his loyalty is to his crew and to Starfleet, the people of Starfleet, not to the institution of Starfleet.
Mm-hmm. He's a spirit of the law, not letter of the law kind of leader. And I've always liked that about him.
Yeah.
There is a phrase that I want you to keep in mind. It will not be relevant for, it'll be the culmination of something. We won't get to it for a while, but I just want you to keep it in your mind. I think I can live with it.
Hmm. There's a lot of wide eyes all of a sudden.
This is one of those things that I talk about with people occasionally, and I think that DS9 broke Star Trek a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think once there are certain points we'll get to within DS9's arc and Sisko's arc that make people think that this that where DS9 eventually goes is what Star Trek should normally be. But I think that
you can't always do dark with Star Trek. It works as the exception, not the rule.
I think we'll get into this more in terms of DS9's role in it, but there's been the trend toward, like, portraying Starfleet as something that's, like, fundamentally corrupt, etc.
Which I don't think is... I think that the idea that the Federation is rotten at the core and that Starfleet is Starfleet is, like, an imperialist mission is, yeah. I think inherently engaging in the text bad faith.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
What is this, some kind of Star Trek Into Darkness?
My impression, as someone who has not watched as much Trek as you guys, is that the older Treks treat the Federation of the older Treks is corrupt in the way that, like, an HOA is corrupt. Like, it's not evil like a colonialist European nation is evil. It's evil like white people in a gated community who think they know what's best and are being kind of shitty about it.
Evil. And it's like one of those organizations that's like just too large. I feel that's one of the impressions I have, especially in TNG, is that, like, that it's so large that it is, like, incredibly scattered. And, like, you do end up with these like admirals who, like, just go nuts.
I will push back. So you and I have had this argument. You and I have had this argument before, because TNG admirals are always pieces of shit.
Oh yeah, but
there's like one good admiral in TNG, which is so funny.
But it's always more like that the admirals are fucked up, not that the institution is rotten at its core.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, Star Trek, like, the Federation itself is often criticized by alien cultures, which, you know, end up being enemies or soon to be allies. And I think that's really important and really interesting, because the Federation needs room to grow.
Yeah.
It needs to be something that is constantly getting better. It doesn't have to be corrupt at its core, but if there are things that it's overlooking that it's doing wrong like in the case of how it is unable to protect the people who form the Maquis because of its insistence on adhering to a treaty that it's in with a culture that has no interest in honoring the terms of it.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting situation where they are too focused on this peace at all costs, ending the war, saving lives throughout the galaxy thing. And they're not as interested in the idea that they may have made a bad deal and now people are suffering for it, people who are their citizens.
I think one of the first episodes that really an early episode that really delves into this in an interesting way is Ensign Ro too.
Yeah. Yes. Love it.
Because we've got nobody on that ship gets it.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're bad people, but they don't get it either. So, and it's a very interesting episode. I love that episode.
Can I toss like a meta like this is sort of like a meta in universe, like if I can give a Watsonian answer for this.
Oh, absolutely.
The Federation has not had an existential threat in almost 80 years.
Yep.
The Cardassian Wars were border skirmishes. They weren't like, you know, a colony might get massacred, but the Cardassian Union was never like an existential threat.
They were never coming for Earth.
In the way that the Klingons were, you know.
And then you got the Borg.
Yeah. And so you have, you know, from Undiscovered Country, which is like 2290 to 2365 or whatever with the Borg, you basically have 75 years of the Federation, like, it's Pax Federation.
Yeah.
It's basically 75 years of, you know, science ships, monster maroon uniforms, and those ugly maroon uniforms, I think, are like the symptom of the rot inherent in Starfleet's command of like it's not a defense organization. It's the Coast Guard, with science experience. Then the Borg come and slap their shit around, and then 2 years later, you have DS9.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
There's all this institutional stuff that is still stuck in there of peace at any cost. And
I just had a thought because I find it fascinating that my favorite Star Trek game that we've ever had now is the one that's just Stellaris. I love it.
Star Trek Infinite.
Star Trek Infinite is great. And I feel like it actually aligns very well with the problem, like my specific problem every time I play Stellaris and like every time I play Star Trek Infinite as the Federation, which is that I like dump all of my resources at the start into like, you know, science and technology and stuff like that, and culture. And then you have a problem, TM, at some point, and you just like overcompensate by like, okay, well, now I need to build all these warships and like, you know, amp up all the defense and everything and, you know, have policies that, you know, are more militaristic and stuff like that because I have to survive. And I feel like this is one of the best parts of Star Trek Infinite is that it actually like recreates that like what happens in the Federation by accident.
Mm-hmm. I would say that is good. I mean, I don't think Star Trek Infinite is a perfect game, but I think that is good game design.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a really random thing, but we get the first appearance of one of our unnamed character, one of our like unnamed off screen characters in this one, which is Dax's on again, off again boyfriend.
Oh, right.
Bodet.
Yeah.
The freighter captain with the translucent skull.
Yeah. I love that conversation too between them.
I do too. So when I'm watching this episode, all I can see is Kira asks Dax out on a date. She's really put off when Dax says, "I got a date with Bodet, a man." And Kira's just like, "Well, that's great, I guess. You know, if that's what you want to look at," implying that she would love to be looking at Dax instead. It's a fraught conversation that quickly devolves into the two of them sniping at each other about romantic tension.
It is a weirdly fraught conversation. It is. Mm-hmm. There's weird tension in that conversation.
Yeah.
Followed immediately by Calvin running into Sisko and being like, hey, let's go to the other room so we can talk about how hot and weird it is that Dax is hot.
Yeah.
I love the thing where it's like, that woman knows more about me than any woman, including my wife.
Yeah. He's like, did you sleep with her? And he's like, no, of course not. And he's like, yeah, that'd be weird, right?
Can I sleep with her?
Would that be weird? Would that be weird to you?
Speaking of weird sexual tension, I do want to call out again, I mentioned it in the summary, but I do think it's fucking weird that Bashir's role in this episode is eye candy.
Well, that makes sense.
To show up and get tasered. And then his one line in this episode is he asks like a dumb fucking question that is so thoroughly beneath even him. Like, everybody looks at him like, Julian, you're not here to talk. And then he just goes quiet. How did this man get paid for this? Could they not have brought on a red shirt to do this?
I think something that I do find funny in this is that we get to see some bad CGI from Odo in this episode.
Oh yeah.
Hold on. Your line in the our notes for this episode had me in stitches.
Yeah, it's like, Odo used Goo Whip. It's super effective.
Odo pissed me off a little bit in this episode. I love Odo.
Please let me be a fascist. I want to violate some rights, baby.
He's like, the Federation won't let me have a police state. And they're like, well, it didn't go well for the Bajorans.
Yeah. And like,
it used to be safer when we were run by the fascists.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Seriously, yeah. Shut the fuck up, Odo.
So this is,
I love him, but sometimes he sucks.
He starts out, we refer to him as variations on wet fascist for like the whole first season.
Yeah.
And then he had a little run there where he was mostly getting hit on uncomfortably and then flirting with Quark. And we kind of liked him for a little bit. And love then that. In this episode, he's just like, nope, I want to bust some heads and violate some civil rights.
Speaking of, you know, DS9 containing characters that have many facets and, you know, a duality to them, because Odo can simultaneously be a wet fascist and like a sad little meow meow, right? Like,
yeah, he really is.
And a wet blanket.
He's like, yeah. I think it really depends on, like, I don't want to like put it out, but sometimes it just feels like, what side of the bed did the writer get up on?
Yeah.
Because it's sometimes we get like, I want to violate some civil liberties. At other times, it's like, wow, I want to explore the wonders of being a shapeshifter and like having some awkward social tension. Oh no,
yeah.
And sometimes it's just like, you know, whatever. And
sometimes it's the, like, I will stand up, you know, I will stand up for the oppressed no matter what, Odo, which is like completely at odds with the like fascist Odo. Yeah. It's,
well, as long as they're not his oppressed, because if they're his oppressed, he wants to.
As long as they're not like causing crimes, right?
Odo is tough for me because Odo and Quark's relationship is so good and so hot. And it only works because if you imagine that Odo is cosplaying or role playing, I should say, as a police officer in a sexy game of cops and robbers, because then it works super well, because he'll be flirting with Odo and he'll be flirting with Quark and they'll be having moments that are truly spectacular. But then he'll ruin it by being like, and I'm going to lock you in jail forever and torture you. It's like,
and Quark's like, joke's on you. I'm into that.
Yeah, or like, that's what I would like to imagine, but then Quark's always like,
see, I always imagine that, like, like, I always imagine, though, that when Odo like makes that threat, what he's really saying is, I'm going to take you back to a jail cell and step on you. And
that works for me. That really works for me. But he's just too serious. He doesn't play it sexy. Like, Sisko makes that joke in here where he's like, forever or whatever.
He's like, how long do you want to keep it here? And Sisko just flat out says, forever.
Yeah, forever, and, Creed. That's how long mutant justice lasts.
I mean, the funny thing is like, you can tell, like, Sisko, like, the way Sisko delivers it is pretty serious, but you can tell that it's I don't have time to, I do not have an answer for this question right now. So I'm just saying forever to be like dramatic and
yeah,
and a bitch.
I want I want to laugh at that, and I want to be like, oh, you. But then I also know that this is a real, like, justice system with a real cop, with a real criminal. And, like, I mean, obviously it's in Star Trek, but, you know, these people aren't role-playing for funsies. Like, Quark is not getting out of there for a while. He sold weapons.
Except
to a terror.
He's back in, like, the
he will, yeah.
Which is my favorite part of this, is that, like, he is back in the next
I mean, like, man, the man, like, got critical information out of that Vulcan by out-logicking her with his, like, with Ferengi capitalism. Like,
you know what? You're right. Maybe this is actually a role-playing thing for them, because he just lets him out the next morning like he's been in the drug tank or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I feel like it's like he earned his. This is what always happens with Quark, right? It's that he fucks up, but then he earns his place back. I have a few more, like, notes on this episode too. My favorite one of my favorite parts is when Dukat is, his line is, education is power, joy is a vulnerability. And I'm like, wow, Dukat, are you, like, part of grad school admin?
I read that line and just died. That's so good.
What an interesting comment on the education system of Cardassia. Yeah. We're often seeing humans attack and criticize the education systems of foreign alien governments, not only Cardassia, but the Vulcan education system. We're constantly seeing being slandered by people in the Earth sphere kind of deal. I wonder what's up with that. I mean,
it's people who've never actually engaged with the American academia, because if they had, they would understand that American academia is just as joyless and punishing as anything the Cardassians or Vulcans could come up with.
It's because all writers are art students.
Yes. That's why. Writers write writers. Unless you're on The Simpsons, in which case it's math people.
Oh, Christ. That's very funny.
I also love that, like, Sisko's just, like, got the Cardassians down at this point. When, like, he's talking with the Legate, right?
Legate Parn, who is, I think, our first Legate on the show.
He has that meeting with the Legate, who's like, no, we absolutely are not supplying weapons. And he walks out of that and, like, turns around and is like, so they're selling weapons. Like, they're supplying weapons.
It's like, Central Command is not selling weapons. However, this small rogue group led by Dukat is, like, we've already found and convicted them. We expect Dukat to be killed by the Maquis, so we don't have any problem. And Sisko, yeah, just walks out. He's like, so, yeah, Central Command's doing it. Dukat's not involved at all.
Yeah. And then like, he instantly switched to, like, okay, well, Central Command wants to kill Dukat, so it is my responsibility to keep that man alive. Because that means if Central Command is trying to kill him, that means he's useful.
Yeah, that's a clever little bit from him.
Yeah,
actually.
But he's like, got the Cardassians figured out at this point, and I enjoy it.
Sisko is a little bit of a contrarian sometimes. Like, he will do things just because someone doesn't want him to.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's implicit in the other thing he does, right? Where Central Command wants Dukat dead, so he says we have to keep him alive, definitely. And the Federation really wants the Maquis crushed, and Calvin, who they don't know is leading it at this point, you know, in custody. And he decides pretty much immediately that he's going to try to solve this any other way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, it's unresolved at the end. One of my favorite ways to end a wrestling match or an episode of Star Trek. Unresolved.
I think one of the, like, I think part of it was that they wanted to make the Maquis recurring plot line, because I think it's like,
yeah,
the astropolitics of it is very interesting.
Yeah.
It would be so easy to end it in this episode, and it'd be so lame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be so intellectually dishonest to end it now.
And it is one of those things that because they don't want to nail any, like, specifics down, like, there's no end goals. It's just the Maquis are going to be waging a war against Cardassia. Is that, and they have no real end goal. I think it does lead to the, like, the plot line themselves peter out, and I think it overall leads to the plot element being weaker than intended. But overall, I think it is, like, I like this episode a lot. I like the challenges it is. I am deeply sad that Bernie Casey, who we have talked about on the show before, he was in Babylon 5. He was, like, when the president sends a dude to like chase after a dude who stole some files. The special attaché that the president that Earth sends is Bernie Casey.
Yep.
He's not the only B5 guest star in this episode.
Who else?
John Shuck, who plays what's his name? Leggett Parn in this episode. I knew he had a weird voice.
It. Yeah,
I recognized him.
He's drawl.
His lips too. Incredible. He's got very distinct lips.
Yeah, no, okay. Yeah, no, I hear that now. Oh gosh.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, yeah.
I knew there was a B5 voice in this episode and I was looking at the guest stars, and then as soon as I saw, yep, that was the one.
Yeah, let's talk about Bernie Casey for a second. Yeah. An incredible actor. He only wanted to be in this episode reportedly because he wanted to work with Avery Brooks, which is legit as fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know him best from I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, of all things. He's absolutely fantastic in that movie. He's definitely better than it, but he's been in a lot of really great stuff. He's so good in this, and
yeah, he is.
I wish we had gotten more into the like pain that exists between him and Sisko. Mm-hmm. Like Sisko wasn't able to be there for him when his wife Gretchen died, and that's just kind of mentioned in passing at the beginning of the episode, but it seems to really influence a lot of the events.
There are like so many, like it's another thing where this character, like, it's another character who set up a sort of a mirror to Sisko of like that they both lost their wives. I don't think that Gretchen was lost during Wolf 359 like Jennifer was. I don't think that's what I got from the episode, but like the fact that like Calvin instead, like Sisko says, yeah, I had Jake here, and like it wasn't perfect, but we had each other at least. Meanwhile, Calvin, like, instead throws his life into a Quixotic, it is a Quixotic crusade. Like,
yeah.
It is a movement with no end, fighting against a great power of the quadrants.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which I overall, he does such a great job of being that mirror to Sisko.
I love that literary like comparison from you, Justin, especially considering like the literary comparisons we'll get in the future with Maki.
Yeah, no, we
I just think there's such an unspoken like sadness that Sisko expresses when he says, like, you know, I wish that I could have been there for you the way that, you know, like I had Jake. Mm-hmm. And there's like this moment where they look at each other and you just sense a little like resentment from Cal and a little regret from Sisko. And it sets the stage for everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially like when you have grief like that, it can be easy to focus inward. And I've got to imagine it's like space is a really big place. It's easy to lose track of people.
Like, yeah.
Like, even when you're both on Starfleet, it's like, you know, like, they were neighbors, basically. They, like, one was working in the DMZ, one was on Deep Space Nine. They should have been able to, like, get close together, but it just never happened. And it's like, who knows? Maybe this never happens if, like, Ben reaches out and says, hey, I'll stop by at a runabout, like, in a week or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, how is this the first time they're getting back together is when they're already on opposite sides of a war they didn't know was happening, you know? Yeah.
And speaking of Cal's wife, too, I realized watching this that this is not in the text at all, but somehow my brain, like, always wants to think that that Cal's wife died in one of the, like, border skirmishes. With the Cardassians or something like that, but I think I'm just conflating it with O'Brien's old captain.
Yeah, I think it's just left unsaid exactly what happens. Which,
but somehow like my brain auto fills that in as like a motivation for him.
So Hudson does not reappear in the series. Anna, I will DM you what happens to Cal because it is stated in the series.
All right.
Interesting thing is that Michael Piller. Like, originally, like, when they were writing the episode, Ira Stephen Bearer thought that Hudson had died in the episode. Piller, like, when they were watching it, or, like, when they were watching the dailies and they're coming out of shooting, they, like, apparently, Michael Piller said that it's, like, I think that would have been the right call. Which I think is interesting, but it's, I think it's one of those things that it's, like, I think there are a lot. I think there's a lot of interesting, like, opinions that the writer's staff had of, like, things we should have done that I think, like, retroactively, no, the thing you did was the right choice.
Yeah.
Sisko and, like, not shooting on Cal is a big moral choice of his that I think establishes sort of, like, what his lines are.
And yeah, I mean, it's... I feel like Sisko's kind of vibe there is, like, okay, you know, like, Cal has done bad things and should be brought to justice, but that justice isn't, like, isn't the death penalty. And yeah. It is not Sisko's role to be, you know, judge, jury, and executioner here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like that would have been wildly out of character for Sisko or really any Federation officer to fire on a ship that's not a threat anymore. Maybe he's a traitor, but that's, essentially an execution.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah. That's not a Federation action in most senses. And also, I think Sisko really wants to end this. He seems to really want to put an end to the things that's causing the Maquis, and to him, that's the weapon smuggling, which it's obvious that's not the case. Like, Cardassians stoned Federation citizens in the streets in public. It's a much deeper problem that's not going away. But he definitely thinks it's just because if we stop the gun running, we'll stop the Maquis, and then Cal can join me back, and we can be buddies again, do it lawful, you know? He seems to kind of fundamentally misunderstand the driving cause of this whole thing, but he does want to just solve it rather than squash it.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. I have a hypothetical question for you guys.
All right.
Would O'Brien have done it?
Shot down people in space? I don't know. He's pretty freewheeling.
If O'Brien were in that situation, because O'Brien is a different kind of officer.
He's not
O'Brien
officer.
Is well not
yeah.
officer, but
yeah,
he's
I'm just picking the joke. But like, yeah, it's
he's a different kind of he's experienced some genuine trauma through the war. In that case, I mean, I don't think he would have shot at the Maquis because they're fighting against the Cardassians and he hates the fucking Cardassians. But like, do you think that O'Brien's dedication is to? Do you think he's as dedicated to Starfleet as he is to, you know? Do you think his trauma is greater than his ethics?
I think O'Brien would join the Maquis given the chance. Like, if he was involved with it for long enough, he would pull a like Thomas Riker, in my opinion.
I don't think so though, because we have the TNG episode, which is I feel like there's a very specific TNG episode that is the Wounded. Which is, I think, in my mind, that is the ultimate origin of the Maquis, because we have Captain Maxwell there, and you know we learn about what's happened with the Cardassians and the border colonies, et cetera, et cetera. But like, there's Maxwell and Hudson are not that dissimilar.
Yeah. I think the real difference is that Maxwell, when he goes rogue, he takes like the ship with him. Like, yeah. And Hudson, meanwhile, is like arming civilians. And I think those are two very different types of war crimes.
Yeah, like they've got different, like they take different paths in terms of their actions, but I feel like they're not dissimilar in terms of like the basic character archetype and kind of what the like conflict is going on with them. And O'Brien brings Maxwell home.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. I feel like O'Brien, for like being a veteran and for being somebody who I think has a much more sideways approach to a lot of problems, I think at the core, he is still somebody who he's a Starfleet lifer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And to an extent that I don't think that even like Hudson and Sisko are.
Yeah.
Hudson certainly is not. He was absolutely fine with walking away once he found a better cause.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think like comparatively, I can't ever remember like a reason other than like, for his family, O'Brien ever like feeling like I need to leave Starfleet.
Yeah.
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 Whereas like other people like throughout the series will have that. Like, I think Sisko like in the pilot says that he was ready to resign his commission. Picard has that. It like I think there like various people do that through the series. And O'Brien never really gets to that point because I think it is a part of his identity. And not in the way just like that he's like, I'm a soldier, or in this case, a sailor, but I think it is a thing of like, that I believe in this and this is something that I put my blood into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, O'Brien firmly believes that Maxwell is in the wrong. Like he understands where Maxwell is coming from and is like, no, you are wrong. And brings him home by singing a song, and that is one of my favorite episodes. It's such a good episode.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it lately, Jude, you should watch it. It's a really good foundational episode for O'Brien, and also Colm Meaney is just incredible.
It's the first appearance of Mark. It is the first appearance of the Cardassians, and Mark Olemo plays a Cardassian who is not Goldacott.
Yeah,
I'll have to watch it. You want to hear a funny story? About traumatizing young Jude.
Absolutely.
As a youth, I had watched enough TNG where Colm Meaney was O'Brien. And so consequently, when I was shown at a relatively youthful and thoroughly inappropriate age, Under Siege, and
I thought you were going to say Meaney, Die Hard 2.
No, Colm Meaney plays a... like, I don't know, some sort of like a terrorist pirate. Genuinely, the more traumatizing thing for me at like whatever age that was, like 12 or whatever, was not the naked breasts of the stripper as she pops out of the cake. It was Colm Meaney as a villain. That fucked with me. That stayed with me for a while, as opposed to the other thing.
He does have such a like strong I'm a hero sensibility to him. Yeah. Not like a hero necessarily, but like I'm a good guy.
He's a recently, union man.
He recently showed up in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia to play Charlie Kelly's Irish father. And he's just like the most delightful person ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Colm Meaney.
He plays, fun fact, crossing over into my Tolkien fandom, he plays Tolkien's the Catholic priest that raised Tolkien in the Tolkien movie.
Do we have any other things that we want to talk about in this episode?
I just have one last like bit. Every time Dukat says Cardassians don't make mistakes, my brain just fills in attention Bajoran workers.
We're gonna get to that soon.
So Jude, I'll leave you with that teaser.
I look forward to it.
All right. Anybody else speak now?
I think we've mostly covered it all. It's a good episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sakona was innocent. Innocent of all crimes. She didn't do nothing. Guilty of being a smoke show.
I've for the record, I have played was Sakona who I used for the like character art for that that Star Trek RPG
Probably.
Game that we played?
I think so. She's great. I honestly,
because every time I play a Star Trek RPG, I must play a Vulcan. It is required.
Yeah.
All right. So next time we are going to be covering episodes 22 and 23 of season 2, The Wire and Crossover.
Oh fuck yes!
I am one hooting and two hollering. We are going to
what a lineup.
I can't wait to see what this is all about.
What a lineup. You gotta live message those, Jude.
Steve, do you want people to find you on the internet?
Go ahead if you can. You don't have to go looking for me though. You can find me on Twitter. It's called X now. I hate that. Blue Sky, Tumblr, whatever, at Howdy Duda. That's H-O-W-D-Y-D-U-D-A. And specifically, I'd like you to look, by the time this episode comes out, My personal Star Trek podcast will be out. It's called Trek Static. That's Trek Static, like ecstatic, but it's Trek followed by static. You'll find it. It'll be everywhere. It'll be me and my partner, Nathan, and we will be talking about Star Trek comics.
Fantastic. Awesome. That's awesome. Very exciting.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. So that has been it for us. Until next time, just keep circling. Keep circling. Just keep circling.
Just keep circling.
Yeah.
Just keep circling.
Just keep circling.
The Babylon Project is an independent production. All views expressed on the show are our own. Clips from the original show remain property of the original owner. Music information can be found in the show notes. The rest of the show is licensed under a Creative Commons 4.0 share alike no derivatives license.